about how a lack of funding is impacting teacher recruitment.
I have 31 children with education, health and care plans. Again, quite a bit above the national average. 11 of these children are in our autism unit. The autism unit ought to have 14 children, but at the moment we've only got 4 members of staff, not 5. We've been trying for a year to recruit a 5th member of staff, and until we do so, we can't have any more children in the unit.
The UK has been gripped by waves of public sector industrial action for months, brought on by double-digit inflation and a cost-of-living crisis. Despite the inconvenience caused by the strikes, public support for them remains strong.
I support it. I think the government should get back round the table and offer a decent pay increase so they can get back to work.
I think it's not surprising and absolutely inevitable, and I fully support the teachers.
And while the government twiddles its thumbs, there will be another strike on May the 2nd, once again keeping hundreds of thousands of teachers and students out of the classrooms. Saeed Puriza, London.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol visited the White House in Washington for a summit with U.S. President Joe Biden. The two celebrated the 70th anniversary of the U.S.-South Korea alliance and discussed responses to North Korea's nuclear and missile development, to which the U.S. leader issued a warning.
A nuclear attack by North Korea against the United States or its allies or partisans or partners is unacceptable and will result in the end of whatever regime were to take such an action.
President Yoon has sought to strengthen the alliance with the U.S. to include a stronger commitment to extended deterrence, the U.S. so-called nuclear umbrella, and the regular deployment of U.S. strategic assets, weapons which can deliver a nuclear strike.
Sustainable peace on the Korean Peninsula does not happen automatically. Our two leaders have decided to significantly strengthen extended deterrence of our two countries against North Korea's nuclear and missile threats, so we can achieve peace through the overwhelming superiority of our forces and not a false peace.
Under the new policy, U.S. nuclear submarines will make port calls in South Korea for the first time in 40 years. New U.S.-South Korea military activities were outlined in the summit communique, the Washington Declaration. It describes the formation of a nuclear consultative group for the U.S. and South Korea to better coordinate responses to North Korea's nuclear and missile developments. Meanwhile, peace activist leaders rallied in front of the presidential office in Seoul. They contend such aggressive U.S.-South Korea policies and resumed large-scale joint military drills only increase tension.
Only dialogue and negotiation can generate peace and denuclearization on the Korean Peninsula. The South Korean and U.S. authorities should immediately stop deploying strategic assets and practicing war and abolish expansionary deterrence policies. We must engage in dialogue with North Korea without conditions.
With Washington's blessing, President Yoon has also moved to participate in a trilateral alliance with Japan and the U.S., despite widespread public opposition. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In spite of the government's ongoing legal battle with the Supreme Court over elections, 180 lawmakers gave Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif their full confidence in his ability to lead the country, granting him a vote of confidence from the National Assembly.
The National Assembly of the Islamic Republic of Pakistan reposes its full confidence in the leadership of Mia Muhammad Shehbaz Sharif as the Prime Minister of the Islamic Republic of Pakistan.
Sharif praised his party members and allies for their support after being elected last year with 174 votes to succeed Imran Khan, who was ousted in a vote of no confidence.
Parliament ne mujhe jo vote of confidence diya hai.
This parliament elected me as the Prime Minister. If this parliament reaches a decision after debate and obliges the government and cabinet, then it is mandatory for me to respect its decision. The judiciary does not have the right to rewrite the constitution. This is a violation of the law and the constitution.
The former Pakistani Premier Imran Khan, who has been attempting to force early elections, has suffered a major setback as a result of the governing coalition's show of power. Khan dissolved his party's local governments of the Punjab and the Khyber Pakhtunkhwa provinces in January in an effort to press the government for holding early elections. However, the ruling coalition turned down his demands despite intervention by the country's top court, arguing that the government is unable to hold elections in May due to shortage of financial resources and the country's deteriorating security situation. Khan's political party PTI believes that government is afraid of its possible defeat in the upcoming elections, and that's why it is using delaying tactics.
We want to get the country out of this chaotic situation through holding fresh elections. Our mission is to find a solution through these discussions, and we believe that whatever solution we propose will be in accordance with the constitution.
Meanwhile, following the directives given by the top court, both the government and the opposition started negotiations to set a time frame for holding fresh polls in the country.
Although the talks between the government and the opposition have been initiated on the directives of the country's top court, analysts say it is unlikely that these negotiations will yield any positive result, as the ruling coalition seems determined to complete its constitutional term, which will be ended in August this year. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
A loss that can be never replaced. At the age of 69, Nader Talibzadeh succumbed to his heart disease at a hospital in the Iranian capital. Now, a year after he was laid to rest, the veteran Iranian movie producer, director, and researcher is revered as a champion and, in the words of leader of the Islamic Revolution Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, a revolutionary researcher and artist.
Talibzadeh believed that the Islamic Revolution is a light that should shine on the whole world. He believed that it is our job to spread the message of the Islamic Revolution. That is why he made so many documentaries.
It is with this mentality that Nader Talibzadeh founded the Ammar International Popular Film Festival in 2010. Talibzadeh's death has been widely grieved in Iran and across the region, where he was known as the face of resistance media.
The legacy of Nader Talibzadeh was, if I want to put it in like two or three words, to be the voice of the voiceless, to always support the oppressed people all around the globe, not in this country, not only in the countries in this region, but everywhere in the world. If you've seen his documentaries, if you've seen his programs on Press TV, on the other channels, and on also on YouTube, he started a show on YouTube called Nader's Show. He spoke about everything in every part of the world. So his legacy is to always call for justice, to be the voice of the voiceless, and hopefully we will continue this path and we will hold on to his legacy.
During his fruitful career, Nader Talibzadeh directed, wrote, and produced numerous award-winning documentary films. Following a decade of research in historical documents based on the Holy Quran and the Bible, in 2007, he produced his first feature-length movie titled The Messiah. In this movie, he presented an Islamic perspective on Jesus and his teachings.
He was there whenever he was needed. His TV shows were aimed at raising public awareness, and in short, he was the voice of the Islamic Revolution.
His interviews with foreign guests on his TV shows were very educational. He used media to shed light on the unknown. He was a great teacher.
Most importantly, Talibzadeh served as the chairman of the International New Horizon Conference, an annual event that scrutinizes the hegemonic policies and war crimes of the U.S. and the Israeli regime. Together with his wife Zainab Mahana, they were blacklisted and sanctioned by Washington for organizing the conference.
The veteran Iranian journalist, TV producer, show host, documentary filmmaker, and director Nader Talibzadeh passed away a year ago, but his memory lives on, and he will always be remembered as one of the most influential cultural figures in Iran. یسومیش احمدی، تهران.
The embassy of Iran in Russia hosted a reception on the occasion of the Day of the Army of the Islamic Republic. A number of guests congratulated the representatives of Iran on the achievements in the industrial and defense sectors.
While some states bend to dictates of the United States, Iran boldly acts as it sees fit. Iran has had significant military achievements. The areas of military technical cooperation have shown that Russia takes a lot from Iran, but it also means that Russia gives a lot to Iran. In the near future, the Iranian army will be much stronger in terms of combat aircraft, anti-aircraft systems, and other things. In addition, new opportunities have been brought forth regarding cooperation between Russia, Iran, and China.
Russian-Iranian relations have taken a new direction as the two countries are under similar Western pressure, which necessitates more cooperation between Tehran and Moscow. Recent quadripartite meeting of defense ministers of Iran, Syria, Russia and Turkey in Moscow shows that cooperation is not limited to the military field, but it also covers other areas.
The trilateral cooperation between the three countries is very important for the stability in the region as well as in the whole world. We need to strengthen this cooperation because there is a kind of complementarity of interest between the three countries' policies. This is why each one of us need the two others. And we are not just friends, we became strong allies. So alliance means that you should take into consideration the interest of others. And this is exactly what's happening between the three of us.
In his speech, the representative of the Ministry of Defense of the Russian Federation noted that military cooperation between Russia and Iran is a fundamental element in the bilateral relations and is of a strategic nature.
The Army Day is celebrated in Moscow on a high level. Iranian embassy has organized a reception in honor of this day for many reasons. Now that Russian-Iranian military cooperation has reached a new grade, the reception is attended by important guests, ambassadors, politicians and military attaches. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
The Judiciary's International Affairs Department, following up on a lawsuit filed by the families of the victims of the 2017 terror attacks in Tehran by the Daesh terrorist group. Deputy Chief of Iran's Judiciary announced the verdict on Wednesday. According to the court ruling, the United States government and nine individuals and entities, including former U.S. Presidents Barack Obama and George W. Bush, retired U.S. General Tommy Franks, the U.S. Central Command, the U.S. Treasury Department, the CIA, as well as Lockheed Martin Corporation and American Airlines, must pay $9.95 million in compensation for financial damages and $104 million for moral damages, as well as $199 million for punitive damages, with the fine totaling around $313 million. The court cited statements by high-ranking U.S. officials about the country playing the main role in organizing and directing terrorist groups, particularly the role of the CIA in creating terrorist groups, including Daesh.
We unleashed fury all over the Middle East, and it was a terrible mistake. And then Obama came in, and normally you want to clean up. He made a bigger mess out of it. He made such a mess. And then you had Hillary with Libya. So sad. In fact, in many respects, you know, they honor President Obama. ISIS is honoring President Obama. He is the founder of ISIS. He's the founder of ISIS. Okay? He's the founder. He founded ISIS. And I would say the co-founder would be crooked Hillary Clinton. Co-founder, crooked Hillary Clinton.
On June 7, 2017, Iran's parliament and the Imam Khomeini Mausoleum in the capital, Tehran, came under terrorist attacks. Four gunmen disguised as women entered parliament and opened fire on security guards there. And separately, gunmen attacked the Imam Khomeini mausoleum, opening fire on the people inside the compound. At least 17 people were killed and nearly 50 were injured in these attacks, which were later claimed by the Daesh terrorist group. The Wednesday ruling is based on complaints filed by families of three people killed and six wounded in those attacks. This comes as a number of U.S. court verdicts over years have ordered compensation to be paid from seized Iranian assets to victims of various incidents worldwide, including the September 11 attacks. Gizumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
The EU's industry and economy was built thanks to decades of cheap gas supply from Russia. Now the bloc has shut that supply off due to the war in Ukraine. A mild winter ensured reasonable energy storage was maintained in the EU, and prices, while very high, did not bring the bloc to breaking point. The US has made a fortune by exporting LNG, liquefied natural gas, to the 27-nation bloc. Lawmakers warn there could be greater competition for LNG in 2023.
If China were to return to 2021 LNG consumption levels, the EU could end up with a gap between demand and supply of 27 billion cubic meters, which is no small amount. Citizens need to be reassured. We can't just pray for another mild winter.
There have been calls during a European Parliament debate for the EU to urgently up its game regarding energy storage technology.
The EU has only a limited amount of storage capacity, with the majority of energy being stored in the form of pumped hydro, which has significant geographical limitations.
Experts warn that energy shortages in the coming months could push EU inflation through the roof. The bloc's leaders are looking towards Africa and the Middle East for supply, but that's a costly exercise.
The problem is that European leadership is not leading Europe to a better future. The problem is that they are servants of American lobby and they're providing exclusively the interests of Americans.
Iran could solve the EU's energy needs, but the bloc is following the United States down the path of sanctions. Legislators are also critical of moves being made domestically.
Germany has just closed its last nuclear reactor. That is a catastrophe. Germany is risking increasing prices. It's a huge mistake.
Given the dire implications associated with a potential energy crisis, many lawmakers here are calling on those who shape EU foreign policy to put the interests of citizens ahead of demands emanating from Washington. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A new report on global military spending found that the European Union's expenditures soared 13% last year to reach $345 billion. That means the bloc is the world's second largest arms purchaser, sprinting far ahead of China, but spending well less than half of the United States. European military spending has now reached its highest level since the end of the Cold War 30 years ago. The historic increase in European military spending comes despite once-in-a-generation inflation records, as their sanctions campaign against Russia keeps backfiring against the Western economy. Brussels has repeatedly ramped up the conflict in Ukraine with once-unthinkable arms deliveries. European arms are already all over Africa and the Middle East due to Western support for failed interventions in places like Libya, Syria, across the Sahel, and elsewhere.
Europe must prioritize a diplomatic solution in Ukraine. The danger is that when there are guns on the ground, one day somebody might use them. The only way this ends is with the destruction of either Ukraine or Russia. Are with people finally getting around a table and working through issues diplomatically.
Last year, Finland, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia recorded the biggest increases in military spending. Globally, defense expenditures increased 4% this year to a record $2.24 trillion. That only barely exceeds the $1.98 trillion budgeted this year for the United States Department of Defense. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
We'll be right back.
in the limelight.
International Monetary Fund, IMF, has warned that the world economy is facing its weakest period of growth since the 1990s in the next 5 years due to problems triggered by the pandemic and political tensions around the world. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Bloomberg, the International Monetary Fund has warned that its outlook for global economic growth over the next 5 years is the weakest in more than 3 decades, urging nations to avoid economic fragmentation caused by geopolitical tension and take steps to bolster productivity. The emergency lender sees the world economy expanding about 3% over the next half decade as higher interest rate bite. Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva said in a speech in Washington recently, "That's the lowest medium-term growth forecast since 1990 and less than the 5-year average of 3.8% from the past 2 decades. For 2023, global gross domestic product, GDP, will likely expand by less than 3%, she said. That's in line with the fund's January forecast of 2.9%. About 90% of advanced economies will see growth slow this year, as tighter monetary policy weighs on demand and slows economic activity in the U.S. and euro area, the IMF said. It plans to release a more detailed World Economic Outlook report on April 11th as part of its spring meetings held together with the World Bank. Georgieva said in a Bloomberg television interview with Tom Kinn, the world economy as a whole is now less able to support the weakest members. Why? The peace dividend is gone. Some emerging markets are showing strength, particularly in Asia, with India and China expected to account for half of global expansion. But low-income nations are hamstrung by weakening demand for their exports, with their per capita income growth remaining below that of the emerging economies. Poverty and hunger that increased during the coronavirus pandemic could climb. Despite the bleak growth outlook, high inflation means that central banks must continue to raise interest rates as long as financial stability pressures remain limited after recent banking industry upheaval in the U.S. and Switzerland, Georgieva said. If the banking system becomes unstable, policymakers will face more complicated trade-offs between inflation and the safeguarding the financial system, Georgieva added. Be vigilant and more agile than ever. Policymakers are set to converge on Washington for sessions focused on numerous global challenges, from unsustainable debt in developing nations to inflation to climate change. Georgieva said in her speech, with rising geopolitical tensions, with inflation still running high, a robust recovery remains elusive. That harms the prospects of everyone, especially for the most vulnerable people and most vulnerable countries. Georgieva's stark message comes a day after the IMF warned that geopolitical fragmentation driven by tensions between the U.S. and China risks damaging the global economy, with foreign direct investment and other capital increasingly being channeled toward aligned blocks of countries. She repeated a warning from January that longer-term trade fragmentation, including restrictions on migration, capital flows, and international cooperation, could cut global gross domestic product by as much as 7%, equivalent to the combined annual output of Germany and Japan, or about $7 trillion. Interruptions to technology trade could see losses as large as 12% of GDP for some countries, Georgieva said. She said in the television interview, "Getting on a path of less fragmentation in the world economy is good for everybody." Meanwhile, RT noted, the world economy is facing its weakest period of growth since 1990s in the next 5 years due to problems triggered by the pandemic and political tensions. A severe slowdown in the global economy last year following the COVID-19 pandemic and the conflict in Ukraine is set to continue in 2023 and could persist for the next 5 years, Georgieva warned. Global GDP will grow at about 3% over the next half decade compared to an average of 3.8% seen in the past 20 years, representing the worst economic performance in more than three decades. The IMF expects global GDP to expand by less than 3% this year, which is in line with its January projection of 2.9%. Last year, global growth almost halved following an initial post-pandemic rebound in 2021, sliding from 6.1% to 3.4%, Georgieva said, ahead of the IMF World Economic Outlook report, which is due to be released very soon in the future. Up to 90% of advanced economies are likely to experience a decline in their growth rate this year, she warned, with activity in the US and the Eurozone hit by higher interest rates. Georgieva said, with rising geopolitical tensions, with inflation still running high, a robust recovery remains elusive. That harms the prospects of everyone, especially for the most vulnerable people and most vulnerable countries. The IMF head warned against economic fragmentation stemming from geopolitical tensions and urged countries to take action to boost global productivity. According to IMF, soaring inflation facing most of the world's wealthy nations will force central banks to continue interest rate hikes, adding pressure to the banking industry despite financial uncertainty following recent turmoil with lenders in the US and Switzerland. She urged the world community to be vigilant, more agile than ever, adding that regulators may come across more complicated choices to protect the financial system amid persistent inflation and challenges in the banking sector. Long-term disintegration in global trade, such as restrictions on capital flows and international cooperation, as well as curbs on migration, could slash global GDP by up to 7% or $7 trillion, which is the equivalent of the combined annual production of Germany and Japan, IMF warned.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
This one lay. Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has hosted his Iraqi counterpart in the capital, Tehran. He slammed the U.S.'s presence in West Asia. He also said enhanced relations between Iran and Iraq is beneficial to the whole region. We ask, when it comes to Iraq, is that relationship better, more important than the one with the U.S.? If Iraq holds resources like oil and gas, then why should the U.S. even be in that equation and have any say in it? Well, in this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at Iran and Iraq's relationship and how the U.S. has used Iraqi territory and airspace for its own motives, like collaborating against Iran. First, let me introduce our guests. Kevin Barrett, editor at Veterans Today, joins us from Madison. Also joining us is Robert Fantina, author and journalist, who joins us from Kitchener. Gentlemen, welcome. Kevin Barrett, first over to you. You know, these days, any trips made in West Asia by any high-ranking officials is important because of the geopolitical shifts that are happening. So just a very simple question. What are your thoughts on why Iraq's president is visiting Iran, and it has been at the invitation of Iran and President Ebrahim Raisi?
Well, it seems that the region is recovering from centuries of Western onslaught, and in particular, decades of American domination, culminating in the barbaric invasions after the September 11th, 2001 false flag operation, in which the region was essentially destroyed on behalf of Israel, or at least badly damaged. And the region is now recovering from that period of the Americans invading and laying waste to the major countries, the seven countries in 5 years that General Clark told us that 9/11 was really all about destroying. And now the U.S. is bogged down in a losing effort in trying to overthrow Russia through Ukraine. The American PNAC neocons, who wanted this to be a new American century, recognize that China's rise is probably unstoppable. A few of them are crazy enough to want to try to stop it militarily, and that's actually where the COVID pandemic came from, but that's another story. In any case, their attention has been distracted by other events in the world, and they no longer are focusing all of their attention on West Asia on behalf of the Zionists. So the U.S. has stepped back, and the other nations are starting to recognize that the future is not going to be American-influenced nearly to the extent it was in the past. So Iran and Saudi Arabia, most importantly, have started on their path to reestablishing relations and having good relations under the tutelage of China. And now Iran is reassuming its role as a key sort of central player in the region by working to hopefully mostly peacefully put an end to this U.S. occupation of Iraq, among other countries.
Sure.
And Syria, of course, as well. And so, what we're seeing here is the reassertion of regional actors and the withdrawal of the American imperialists.
Well, one of the things that has been said time and again, Robert Fantina, by Iran, and in this case, again, reiterated by Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi, is that enemies are not pleased with the improvement of relations between Iran and Iraq. That specifically obviously points to the U.S. Why would the U.S. not be pleased with the relationship between Iran and Iraq?
This isn't in keeping with the U.S.'s desires for the region. Iraq and Iran reestablishing or improving relations is a reduction of hostility. That means there will be fewer weapon sales, fewer opportunities for the United States to say that one country or another is in danger and needs more U.S. weapons, more U.S. troops, needs to expand the size and number of the bases. These are things the U.S. wants. The U.S. has never been interested in peace in the Middle East. It's not interested in adhering to international law. It's not interested in respecting the sovereign characters of different countries in the region. So Iran and Iraq, which have had a troubled relationship for many years, it goes up and down kind of, and now with them improving their relations, Iran, as your other commentator mentioned, is reasserting itself. The recent renewal of ties with Saudi Arabia gives Iran a tremendous amount of credibility in the area now, which the U.S. has attempted for decades to erode. But these two countries, Iran, Saudi Arabia, with China brokering the agreement, have said they can put aside their differences, work diplomatically rather than militarily. And the United States is never interested in diplomacy when it feels might makes right, and dropping a few bombs or numerous bombs will simply resolve the problem. Okay. But there's a new way of acting now in the Middle East, thanks partly to China, to Iran, to Iraq, to Saudi Arabia. Some of these countries, Saudi Arabia, of course, has issues with its human rights policies, but at least we're seeing improvement. We're seeing a more peaceful resolution to conflicts, and that can only be positive.
Well, both of you seem to be on the same page, if you agree, Kevin Barrett, when it comes to the major geopolitical shift to occur, and then you have, obviously, the branches that come out of that, and that is the reconciliation between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Now, one thing that Robert Fathina said there, Kevin Barrett, and I'm wondering what you think, and that is the fact that the U.S. has come out and said and given its stamp of approval when it comes to Iran and Saudi Arabia reconciling. But I guess there, Robert Fathina said that one of the major functions the U.S. has had in the region and its interest has been weapon sales. Well, when you have these two key powers in the region to have reconciled, then the weapon sales couldn't transpire. I mean, the Iranophobia is still there, but I don't think the countries in the region are buying that. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that has been one of the biggest factors influencing U.S. policy in the region. It's not only the Zionists. They're the most important factor. They have tremendous power in Washington. But there's also the military-industrial complex lobby and many of these companies, which are often staffed by rotating generals and colonels and so on, people who rotate in and out of the American military and the Pentagon and into, you know, chieftainships at companies like General Dynamics and things like that. They're making money hand over fist on these weapon sales. And the Saudis are well known as historically having overpaid for U.S. weapons. In many cases, the Saudis haven't really been able to operate very well themselves, so then they have to hire more American experts to come in, and pretty soon they're totally occupied. And whatever you want to say about the Crown Prince bin Salman, and I've said a lot of really critical things about him over the years, but it does appear that he is trying to lead Saudi Arabia towards more sovereignty. That is, to get out from under this U.S. occupation of his country. And that's all to the good. And so I think that the American weapons manufacturers who are drinking from this, drinking blood, really, by using this American domination of the world economy through the weaponized petrodollar to end up, you know, selling these countries weapons that they don't really need, that era is coming to an end. And all of this unearned wealth that so many American corrupt institutions have been feeding on is starting to dry up. And I imagine that there are quite a number of people who are starting to panic about this, that they're losing their weapon sales, that the dollar is starting to decline now, and it's quite likely to decline much, much further, and that a whole lot of people who've been gains have to find real productive work for a change.
Okay. Well, let's talk about another important factor, which we seem to forget, at least so far, that's been left out, Robert Fathina. And that is, first, what Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi said in the presence of his counterpart, where the U.S. forces in the region, he has said, brings about insecurity. When we take a look at the numbers, as of March 20th, 2023, you have about 2,500 soldiers, U.S. soldiers, that are deployed mainly in the Al-Assad Air Base. So a simple question that comes out of this is, what is the U.S. doing in Iraq anyways?
What it's doing in Iraq is just trying to hold on to its control of Iraqi oil sources and resources, I should say, and also being sure or trying to assure that the Iraqi government doesn't step out of line, that it continues to toe the U.S. line and do as the U.S. demands.
What would be the U.S. line when you say that? I'm sorry to jump in.
No, that's fine. It's being sure that the hostility to Iran remains. Of course, they failed in that. Is to ensure that the U.S. government gets the oil that it wants, however much it wants. It's to assure that Iraq doesn't get too friendly with Russia or any of the other of the U.S.'s other self-named and self-described enemies. That it simply acts as a puppet of the U.S. in the Middle East. This is something that the government of Iraq has not been interested in doing for some time, and especially in the last few years since the invasion, which was a brutal invasion occupation. It was all a false flag operation. We remember all the talk about weapons of mass destruction, which, of course, were never found because they didn't exist. The U.S. simply wanted to destabilize another country there and gain control over it, install a government that would be friendly to the U.S. and compliant to U.S. demands, and that's what it attempted to do. Okay. However, that's not working quite the way the U.S. expected, which often happens with U.S. invasions.
Well, it wasn't working quite the way that the U.S. expected, and things really got thorny when, Kevin Barrett, you had that U.S. drone strike that was responsible for the assassination of the Iranian general, Qasem Soleimani. Now, when that happened, there was plenty of reason for Iraq not want the U.S. on its soil. As a matter of fact, they went and they took a vote in parliament and they said the U.S. troops need to be ousted from Iraq. So, again, but that hasn't transpired. What are the U.S. troops doing there? I mean, what is their mission there? I mean, what do they do when they wake up? I mean, what purpose do they serve?
Well, that's a question that Americans are asking more and more, and they will be asking increasingly as the petrodollar declines and the ability to pay for all of these American troops stationed all over the world becomes in question. And we're going to start having to ask that. What are they really doing there? Well, in this case, Iraq is occupied. Now, it's something of a stealth occupation. You know, America is not running around the world trumpeting that Iraq is a province of the United States, a colonial possession. But in reality, those U.S. troops there are there along with all kinds of spies and cloak and dagger operatives in this gigantic embassy at the heart of the Green Zone, which really is the nerve center of control of much of official Iraq, same way that the U.S. embassy in Amman, Jordan, largely dominates Jordan, that these American military bases and these parallel institutions, including the crucially important cloak and dagger community people, in this case, many of them working through that mega embassy, that it's running that stealth occupation. You know, the U.S. likes to occupy other countries without deeming them formally as colonial possessions. Japan and Germany have been completely U.S. occupied since World War II, and they still are. They have no real sovereignty whatsoever. And neither does Iraq officially, although due to a kind of a passive-aggressive pushback, the Iraqis have managed to assert a fair bit of de facto independence, even while remaining occupied. But as you say, when the parliament in Iraq votes to expel the U.S. occupiers, and they just ignore it and don't go home, that tells you all you need to know about whether Iraq is sovereign or not. Right. Clearly, they aren't yet. But things are moving in that direction because the U.S. effort to subdue the region has failed. It's now out of control. It's a region dominated by the regional countries, with perhaps China and Russia being ahead of the U.S., in terms of outside forces that can come in and act as honest brokers. And so the writing's on the wall, and we're going to see a new West Asia before too long.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
However, when we talk about Iraq's sovereignty, Robert Fantina, many are not aware of the fact that the U.S. is actually holding Iraq hostage. Just recently, there was a report that revealed that since the year 2003, Iraq is required to send all of its oil revenues to one single U.S. bank account, that Washington has required that, and on top of that, has weaponized the dollar. And this came out at the time when we saw the fluctuations towards the exchange rate in Iraq, where the Iraqi dinar was losing its value because the U.S. actually restricted the access of U.S. dollars for the Iraqi central bank, where it didn't have as much access to its dollars as it used to. The big question is, this is in essence means the U.S. is holding Iraq hostage. Why would Iraq allow something like this, first of all? And what purposes does this serve the U.S.?
Well, a couple of things. Iraq allows it because at this point it feels that the Iraqi government feels it doesn't have a lot of choice. It is making creating choice for and options for itself, partly by improving relations with Iran. We'll see this work improving relations with other countries too, but it is another indication that the U.S. is in complete control of Iraq, or almost complete control of Iraq, when it's even demanding that everything be paid in U.S. currency to one single bank account. This is really criminal behavior because it's not allowing the Iraqi government to function the way that a sovereign government should be able to function, to make its own choices financially. And why is the U.S. doing it? Simply to maintain control. The U.S., as Mr. Barrett said, has colonies around the world. It doesn't call them that, but when one country is completely controlling and dominating another, well, then that's its colony, and that's what we're seeing in Iraq. But Iraq is a colony in revolt, if you want to say that, because it is making steps to gain independence from U.S. domination, and we'll continue to see those. But the U.S. isn't going to walk away quietly. It wants Zionist entity, the apartheid Israel, to be the only powerful country in the Middle East. That's partly due to the U.S., the Israeli lobby in the U.S., but it isn't going to walk away from Iraq easily. It invested trillions of dollars in the war and the aftermath and wants to see a return on its investment, which it's currently seeing, but it's having trouble holding on.
All right. Let's expand a little bit more on this, Kevin Barrett. When you take a look at this hostage situation that the U.S. has Iraq in terms of accessing its dollars, one of the major purposes behind that, based on what many analysts have concluded, is that the reason for the restriction is not only to show Iraq who's in control, but also to control the flow of dollars outside of Iraq to countries like Syria, Lebanon, and, of course, their big target being Iran. Doesn't that go against what Iraq has said in terms of its territory being violated and its sovereignty being violated, and for this, in this case in point, for Iran to be targeted?
Well, yeah, of course, this is a huge violation of Iraq's sovereignty. And it is outrageous that all of the legal, the visible revenues from Iraqi oil all have to go in U.S. dollars into the same U.S. bank account. I mean, that is just such obvious evidence that Iraq is fully occupied and lacks sovereignty that it's interesting how the Western media completely ignores that and sort of goes along with the facade, imagining that Iraq is sovereign and making these decisions on its own. Now, the purpose of this, I think, is, well, this is just one example of the weaponization of the dollar to try to maintain U.S. imperial control. And the problem is, from the standpoint of the managers of the U.S. empire, that these efforts can be counterproductive, because when they sanction everybody and they weaponize the dollar against everybody or against a long list of countries, the other countries, the ones that are not yet being targeted, say, well, wait a minute, this could happen to us too. Maybe we need to get out of dollars. Maybe we need to erect parallel institutions for avoiding these pitfalls of trying to trade in dollars that the U.S. can weaponize against. And so in the last couple of months, the U.S. dollar is starting to slide. And the predictions are that it will slide considerably further. In the worst case scenario, it could lose the vast majority of its value because the U.S. has been printing dollars like there's no tomorrow in order to pay for its vast military occupation of the world, as well as its overspending during the COVID period and so many other things. So there are way too many dollars floating around,
sure.
And the world has been forced to accept them at gunpoint through these kinds of weaponization tactics. But the world isn't putting up with it anymore. They're backing out of dollars, country after country, whether it's Brazil or Turkey, India, not just Russia, China, Iran, and so on. All of these countries are backing out of dollars, figuring out how to get around this U.S. weaponization.
Sure. And lo and behold, you have had Iraq, Robert Fintina, in the past. I believe the initial report came out about 3 weeks ago, or announcement, I should say, that Iraq is actually finalized paying in the yuan for imports from China. So we can see that there's a move towards de-dollarization or to diversify away from the dollar. When you take a look at the fact that that is something that Saudi Arabia is also doing, which by default the GCC countries of the Persian Gulf are also following to do, and if you then take just the U.S. presence, it doesn't really serve much in terms of how you have, on the one hand, regional countries aligned with each other, especially Saudi Arabia and Iran. And then you have, on the other hand, the U.S. without any real support from allies, except maybe for, definitely Israel. And I'm not too sure how Oman and the UAE even stand on this, because you have Syria that has now been embraced by these countries. So the U.S. is kind of standing alone, isn't it?
The U.S. is standing alone more and more. We're seeing a fading of U.S. influence around the world, and most especially in the Middle East. The fact that these countries, and as you mentioned most recently, Iraq, are going to be paying for imports in something other than dollars is a great step for them, because it does indicate their growing independence from U.S. influence and U.S. oppression and repression and, as you put it, being held hostage by the U.S. They're starting to really rebel against this. And the fact that these countries are aligning with each other and building up alliances throughout the Middle East, in addition to some more international, such as with China and with Russia, indicates, again, that the U.S. is decreasing in power and influence, certainly in the Middle East. And this can only bring more peace in the Middle East. The U.S. has destabilized country after country after country, continues to. It's got military bases basically surrounding Iran, threatening the people there.
Right.
It's got it's the brutal sanctions against Iran, which are certainly illegal under international law. But Iran is working to build its own